Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters with your host, Betty Jo Tucker, author of Confessions of a Movie Addict, right here at www.blogtalkradio.com.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. That's right, Dorothy. This is Movie Addict Headquarters. You don't have to be a movie addict to visit here, but if you are one, it's definitely the place for you. I'm your host, Betty Jo Tucker, and today we'll be talking with actor Tim Reed and comedian Tom Dreesen about their fascinating new book called Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White. It's about America's first and possibly only interracial comedy team. And by the way, I think it would make a terrific movie. It's filled with comedy, drama, and suspense, as well as cameos by a host of showbiz greats. Happily, film critic James Cold Harrison is here to help with the show again. And Demos is helping out in the chat today, and I really appreciate that, Demos. Well, okay now, let's begin by welcoming back our good friend, James Cold Harrison, who's the person who first told me about Tim and Tom's excellent book. James, I think these two guys were incredibly courageous to do what they did back in the 60s and 70s, don't you?
Well, they certainly were, and it's nice to be able to talk to them today. I interviewed both of them about a month or so ago, 6 weeks maybe, and did some newspaper articles on them. So it's fun to be able to talk to them again.
Well, I thank you so much for telling me about this wonderful book, because when I was reading about the experiences that Tim and Tom had during this time when they did the comedy team and were the first interracial comedy team, I was completely drawn into their world, and I wanted to hear more about it. And fortunately, they agreed to be on the show to talk about their book. Right now, Tom is already with us, and we're hoping that Tim will call in a little bit later. But let's welcome Tom Dreesen to the show. He's really had quite an interesting career of his own. He's been on The Tonight Show and The David Letterman Show several times, but he also served as Frank Sinatra's opening act for 14 years. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you, Betty Jo? And there's one correction there that people say that I was the opening act for Frank Sinatra for 14 years. I like to think that Frank closed for me for 14 years.
Well said.
Tell them how you look at it.
That's true. That's true. It is. Well, at any rate, we really are impressed, you know, with anyone who's worked with Old Blue Eyes. I know for a fact that James is, and I'm just so glad that you could join us. I want to congratulate you on your wonderful book. How in the world did you and Tim meet, and why did you decide to work together as a comedy team?
Tim and I were, I had just gotten out of the service. It was back in the late 60s. Gotten out of the service. The Vietnam War was raging, and the nation was in somewhat of a turmoil. And Tim had just graduated from Norfolk State College, and E.I. DuPont recruited him into Chicago. I lived on the south side of Chicago, a suburb. Tim moved into that area, and I was in the JCs. I was very active in a civic group called the JCs that do a lot of civic projects and thereby have leadership training programs and things like that. And I had written a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor, a concept that I had.
Wow.
Tim joined the chapter, and the night that I was proposing it, he said, gee, I like that idea. I'd like to work with you on it. And as fate would have it, I already had a guy, but the guy got a new job the next day, so I called this new member named Tim Reed, and he and I went on the project together and developed it so that we were teaching the grade school children the ills of drug abuse when they weren't doing this at college or high school levels.
Right.
And it became very important. And one day, it became number one in 50 states and in 22 foreign countries. JCs use it as a model program in their publications. And one day, a little eighth grade girl said, "You guys are so funny, you ought to become a comedy team." And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us because no one had ever done that before. So we went out and we worked on it for months, and we finally went out and we bombed a few times, but then we finally started getting it together, you know.
Well, and then what motivated you to, after such a long time, to write this book, which I think is just a wonderful book. But what?
I've always thought it was a terrific idea. I always thought it was a great idea. I always thought that the idea of America's first black and white comedy team. But what's even more significant is that we were the last. Not that so much we were the first, that we were the last, and that was 35 years ago. And what's interesting about that is that Tim was really resistant to it. Not that he just thought, well, let's not look back. He's a kind of guy who likes to think forward and not look back. And he just thought, well, they weren't interested then, they wouldn't be interested now. And yet he finally came on board. One night I called him. I couldn't handle it anymore. That I said, no, we've got to do this. I saw the movie Remember the Titans. And I was sitting in the movie theater, and there was a line in that movie, a scene, when the young white kid who had been resistant to blacks being on his team and later became the best friends with a young black kid, when he got injured and had a spinal cord injury, and he's laying in the hospital, and his black friend come rushing in the hospital to see him, and the nurse said, "Son, you can't go in there. That's for family only." And the white kid laying in bed said, "Nurse, what's wrong with you? Can't you see he's my brother?" Well, the back of my hair stood up on my neck, and I left the movie, and I called Tim, and I said, "Tim, that's our story. We have to tell that story, you know."
Oh, I'm so glad that you did get together to tell this, because I just loved it, and I appreciated your candor about how your act was received back then, you know, with the various audiences. But I don't want to monopolize all the time here. I know James has some questions for you, right, James?
Oh, yes, I do. It's nice talking to you again, Tom.
You too, James?
I'm James, yes. I'm the fellow in La Jolla who interviewed
you. Oh, I remember. I remember the interview. I do remember. It was a very good interview.
Yeah. I wanted to know if you could do that same act today, or has political correctness affected comedy where it wouldn't be possible?
No, we could not do what we did. Tim Reed and I worked with total freedom, and so we couldn't possibly do the act that we did in those days. Political correctness would destroy it, you know. There's no question about it. The movie Blazing Saddles couldn't be done today, you know.
Might be right.
Yeah, it couldn't be done today. Yeah. And that's just because I think well-intentioned, but you know, they don't really. I think politically correctness would try to kill comedy. You can't put comedy in a box. If you say to a comedian, "I want you to go out there now and be funny now, but don't say this and don't say that, and be careful what you say there, and don't say this," and you eventually put them in a box, you know.
Yeah.
And that would be very touchy for an interracial comedy team, I suppose. Today, so you were doing it at a time when you had a lot of freedom. And
well, in some respects, yes, and some no. But the point is that we weren't, all of our routines weren't about race. We you know, it wasn't about race at all, not all of it. But the point was, we were a black guy and a white guy having fun on a stage, and that in itself is racial. If we were talking about going to get a hamburger, which we had a routine about that, it was still a black guy and a white guy on the stage. The interesting thing, Betty Jo and James, you know, that today Senator Obama and John McCain are both calling out for discourse. We need more discourse among the races. You know, they keep saying, we need more discourse. Well, Tim Reed and I were that discourse 35 years ago.
Yeah,
and there was not. Yeah, there was. I've always wanted our book to be called Before Our Time. I thought maybe that'll be the name of the movie. But I thought the book should be called Before Our Time, because everybody who reads it, first thing they say is, gosh, you guys are way before your time.
Well, what's the difference between ethnic humor and racist humor?
Well, there's a distinct difference between ethnic humor and racist humor. You know, a racist humor is when the race is the butt of the joke. you know, ethnic humor is when we examine our culture and we find out that we have a lot more in common than we do, we're more alike than we are different.
Yeah.
You know, Tim and I would sit down and explore all the stereotypes that white people had of black people, and we'd explore the stereotypes black people have of white people, and then we could poke fun at that in our act, so that people would walk away and say, "Gosh, it is that was funny, and isn't it silly? Isn't it? It's kind of stupid, you know."
Well, you said that the movie should be called "Before Our Time." And of course, whenever I read anything, the first thing that comes into my mind, will this be a good movie? Because I'm such a movie addict, and so I thought right away, oh, this would be just absolutely terrific. But I didn't know that there were plans for a movie in the works.
Well, the book's only been out like 4 weeks, and we've already gotten people who are interested. You know, because it went to number one on Amazon.com a couple of times. You know, it's like a stock market, Amazon.com. It goes up and down, but several times it went up to number one. And so people have called with interest. A friend of mine's a screenwriter, and he said he opened up the book. He emailed me about 2 weeks ago. He said, I opened the book. I was going to – I had a little notepad next to me. I was going to jot down what I thought would be good movie scenes. He said halfway through the book, I had 19 sheets of paper. I finally stopped. He said, this is a movie. It's a movie that has to be made, you know.
I agree. I think it's just, but who would you want to play Tom Dreesen, and who do you think should play Tim Reed in the movie?
Well, I'm thinking Brad Pitt for me. I don't know. you want to hear a funny story? Betty Clint Eastwood is a good friend of mine, and I wanted to introduce him to Tim. So we went out to dinner one night at Dan Tana's, and I introduced him to Tim. And while we were having dinner, Ryan Flippy came up, you know, and.
Yes.
He had said hello to me. He and I had done a late night show somewhere, and he was talking to me. And Clint said, "Ryan, this is Tim Reed. Tim and Tom were America's first black and white comedy team, and they were the last." He said, "And they've got a book out on their life. It's coming out." That was about a month ago. He said, "It's coming out." And Ryan said, "Wow, that would make a great movie." And I said, "Well, from your mouth to God's ears." He said, "I could play you." And I said, "I was a lot better looking than you when I was your age."
And humble. And you were more humble.
which, by the way, is not true. Young girls are looking at him and walking into the wall after they look at him, you know. He's a good-looking kid, he sure is.
Yes, he certainly is handsome.
Yeah,
I'm just keeping my fingers crossed, because I think it would be a wonderful movie and would be a big hit too. But I was wondering, what's the biggest challenge you faced in writing the book? And of course, you said a little bit about it's only been out for 4 weeks. But what types of reactions have you received about it, other than it should be a movie?
Well, we've gotten great, great reaction around the country. People are, you know, at our book signings and everything. People that have read it are emailing and just have gotten a great deal of reaction. The toughest part of writing the book is that we were painfully honest, and we went down, you know, while we were writing the book, there were times we were laughing so hard that tears were running down our cheeks, and there are other times when we weren't laughing at all and tears are running down our cheeks. Because there's a, you know, the heartache of the book, I mean, there were times... you know, the interesting thing about racism then and now, if there was a black guy, we worked all black clubs and we worked all white clubs. If there was a black guy who didn't like white people, didn't like him at all, he wasn't mad at me. He was mad at Tim for being with me. If there was a white guy who hated black people, he wasn't mad at Tim. He was mad at me for being with Tim, you know. I mean, that was the kind of, the fourth time we're ever on stage, as you read in the book, a guy put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face and then tried to beat me into oblivion, you know.
Wow.
And I boxed when I was in the service, and I had some street knowledge of it, but this guy outweighed me by 100 pounds and attacked Tim and I. And the funny part about that is that we got in the car, and Tim was all scarred up in his face and my chest. I felt like I was never going to breathe again.
Oh.
And I looked at Tim, and Tim said to me, "Hey, welcome to show business."
Scars.
Now, that's what the book is about. It's about we didn't quit. We bonded. I mean, in the service you learn that when you know, when crisis hits, you bond with that person next to you. You don't look at color, race, you know, any of that. I'll get you home if you'll get me home. And so all these hardships that Tim and I endured just made us, you know, closer. But in the end, we broke up. The team broke up, and that's in the book, too. We both have different versions as to why, you know.
Well, yes, and then your individual careers kind of took off too, and Tim with the TV work, with the WKRP in Cincinnati, doing that great character, Venus Flytrap, and his work in Frank's Place. And then my favorite character that he did of all time is Downtown Brown in Simon and Simon. And he,
yeah.
So, but then he started doing some directing and producing of his own, too, I think.
As well as a show called Sister, Sister that he had. Tim's been on more sitcoms than any other actor. As we speak, he's getting a check right now. A check's probably coming to his house right now from some sitcom, you know.
Wow, that's
and Frank's Place was a work of genius. It was a work of art, and that in the book, you could never understand why that show went off the air. And in the book, he runs into Walter Cronkite, and Walter Cronkite tells him why they took his show off the air, you know. And it's just something political that you'll read in the book, you know.
Yes, that's a very interesting part of the book, but I like what you said about Frank's Place being a work of genius, because it was, but I just was so angry when it was, you know, not allowed to go on, you know, it because, but, and it's so hard to see anymore, too. I mean, now WKRP is in syndication, so every once in a while you will see that. But,
yeah, Frank's Place has never been re-released, you know, I think because of the music and stuff, they said that it would was too costly, but that's a shame because, it was a great show. But that's what the book is about. The book is about is what life is the highs and the lows and the, you know, in the world of comedy, stand-up comedy, I've been a stand-up comedian, next year will be my 40th year in the business.
Wow,
but the highest of, thank you so much. The highest of highs, comedy is the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. You know, when it works, there's no describing that great, joyous feeling on a stage of people roaring at something you wrote and created and just delivered right there in the moment. That's the highest of high. And when it doesn't work, it's the lowest of lows, you know.
Oh, yes, and you have to be just so brave, I think, so even if it isn't an interracial comedy team, because it's, you know, you're there. You're there on the stage. You don't have props or anything, and you just have to do it all yourself. And if you're in a team, you have to have the rapport that's going back and forth, which you guys certainly must have had. I'm just so sorry that I never was able to see your act. But
well, when we first started out, we were like any other comedy team. We were learning one another, learning timing, rhythm. But we went on the Playboy circuit, and we were doing six shows a night. In most places, five and six shows a night. And that's when our act really got tight, when the timing got outstanding, you know. And we did 12 different Playboy clubs around the country. You know, by the fifth and sixth show every night, we were as sharp as we could possibly be, you know.
Wow, yeah.
Wow, yeah. Well, you played in... Go ahead, Jim, I'm sorry.
I was just wondering, was it difficult to remember events that happened 35 years ago, or did you prompt each other and say, oh, do you remember this? And I think it would be hard to remember things that happened 35 years ago.
Well, you know what, Tim and I both did that. I had a logbook of some of the gigs we did, and when we would sit at these sessions with Ron Rappaport, who wrote the narrative for this, it did a brilliant job, we would cue each other and say, you know, do you remember that? Do you remember this? But I've always had this phenomenal memory. I mean, Frank Sinatra used to talk to me all the time about that. I could recall places we had been with the most, unique remembrance, you know. I just have a way of, I had this uncanny ability to recall things, you know. When we were doing the book, we were writing, we cued each other, though. He'd say, you remember this, you remember that. And then again, we'd start all laughing again, you know.
Yeah,
it's wonderful to have a memory like that when you're writing a book, and I'm just so glad that you guys did that. What's your favorite part of the book, Tom?
Well, I mean, there's times that about the laughs we had. You know, the opening of the book is one night at the Club Harlem in Atlantic City, and that's a night that we really, really, really got them. And the irony of that whole night is that Tim's father died, and Tim buried him that day and came into Atlantic City that night, and we opened. You know, the Club Harlem in those days was an all-black club their opening night, most opening nights in nightclubs years ago were like Monday night, you close on Saturday. The Club Harlem, you opened on Saturday and closed on the following Friday. But that Saturday night, the first show was 10 o'clock at night. Second show was 2 o'clock in the morning. Third show was 6 a.m. Sunday morning. and all the waiters and the waitresses and the night people came, but also all the pimps and the whores from Newark, from Philadelphia, from Manhattan, from Queens, from the Bronx. The pimps would bring their ladies down, and at 6 a.m. with the sun coming up, they'd all come into this room packed 1,350 people. And that the book opens up with that night and how we received a mean heckler attack me, but yet we countered that and ended up getting a standing ovation, and what that was like that night, you know, what that felt like.
Great. That was a great part of the book. You know, we have a couple of callers, and one might be Tim. Let me check here.
Let's hope so.
Let's hope so, yes.
The late, but still
hello,
here.
Hello, area code 703. You're on Movie Attic Headquarters. Is this Tim?
This is he. Thank you very much.
Tim, welcome to our show. We're so glad you could be here. Tom's been telling us a lot about your wonderful book. And
I only believe half of what he says. Anything about me, I have to reserve.
Well, I just wanted to get an opportunity to thank you personally for the pleasure you've given me with your performances. And I had already stated I loved Venus Flytrap and your work in Frank's Place and Downtown Brown, your character of Downtown Brown and Simon Simon. But the important thing today, of course, is to talk about this great book. We've all agreed it should be made into a movie, and we're now talking about favorite parts of the book.
Great.
What's your favorite part of the book, Tim?
Well, I don't know. I think the part for me that struck was really the part about when we came together in the 5.5 years, because it really defined who we became in entertainment, and also you get an idea how we were able to struggle through and have a career that's lasted 40 years because of what we learned and went through in the 5.5 years we were together.
I think the specific part, Tim, I told him I liked the opening at the Club Harlem, but maybe you might want to describe the Tonight Show, how it changed my life, but it changed your life as well. That's in the book. And
Yeah. I think that there's so many things that happened to us, but I think that when we split up and we went our separate ways, Tom took off first. He was very successful on Tonight Show, and then the next day he's opening for Sammy Davis in Las Vegas. And at that time, I was working at a topless place in Washington. So I looked at what was happening to him, and I felt a great deal of pride in knowing that he had made it, but also a great deal of sadness for myself, thinking I should be up there with him. And that was a real big turnaround for me, because I knew I had kicked my career into high gear and make it. It would have been a shame for either of us to not have made it while the other one had. So it kicked me into high gear, and thank God it did.
Well, it certainly shows that the work that you two did together as a team was helped you grow in, you know, helped your talent grow.
Yes.
And I thought that the last part of the book too, where after you separated, it was just brilliant. And then the way that you came together to write the book, it's just going to be such a wonderful read for our listeners. And I want to mention that on the Blog Talk Radio Movie Attic Headquarters site for today's program, there is the cover picture. And dear listeners, if you will click that cover, it will take you right over to Amazon.com. And I hope that you will order this book, because I recommend it highly. And before I get in trouble with James, I promised him that he could ask some questions about Frank Sinatra. So, James, what do you want to know about Old Blue Eyes?
Well, Tom, of course, went on to have a brilliant career, comic career, and he worked for a while with Frank Sinatra for, I think, 14 years. Did you ever get close to him personally?
Yeah, I was a pallbearer at his funeral, and I spoke at his funeral. And the years I toured with him, you know, we got very close. I would go stay at his house 6-7 times a year, and we would ride around in the desert sometimes, just he and I, till dawn. He never went to bed till the sun came up. So we got very close, yeah. And there were times he was the boss, because when you do the show, he was in charge. Everybody knew that. and he every night was a command performance, so he was the boss. But there were other times he was like a friend to me, a buddy, we hung out, and then there were times he was like a dad to me, you know. So, yeah, I got very close to him. I miss him every single day of my life. Every day I think about him in some capacity or another.
And I like the way that's dealt with in the book. You know, we have another caller who's been waiting patiently. I'm going to see if we can get him or her hooked on to the network. Hello, area code 607. Who's calling, please?
Hi, Betty Jo. It's Jazz. How are you?
Fine, thank you, and much better because we're hearing from you. This is one of our wonderful regular callers, Jazz Shaw, who's also a host on Blog Talk Radio. Jazz, did you have a question or comment for Tim or for Tom?
Yeah, I've been tracking the web chat going on because it turns out that Nikki and Demos are unable to get on the phone right now.
Oh, some technical difficulties.
Everybody's been really excited about one aspect of the conversation, talking about, you know, people that were very early adopters, if you will, about bridging the racial gap and finding ways to cross those lines when it was much, much harder to do than it is today, and how important it was to make that very critical distinction that your guest made about the difference between racist humor, quote unquote, and ethnic humor. And those are very different things, and it's good to hear someone talk about that. And one of the big questions that was coming up in the chat was if your guests would care to address how they view that. We don't want to spin it off into a whole political thing, but how they view this whole comedy thing and the ability to work together in terms of, for example, the current presidential election, because we're at this unprecedented moment, you know, with just a very historic election going on. And can we get some humor in that without being offensive?
Oh, that's a good question. Who'd like to jump in on that, Tim or
Tom?
I'll give it to Tim.
Yeah. All right. I think, first of all, there's a big difference, as Tom mentioned, between racial humor and racist humor. You know, and I think what has happened today is we've become too politically correct. Everything has to pass through the pundits' meter, and the pundits define now have taken over the human aspect of comedy, and everything's defined by what someone thinks it means. So in order to do the kind of humor we were doing today, we would be run out of town. I mean, we'd be on YouTube and something would be taken out of visual context and we'd be through.
Right.
So I don't know that today, and I find it saddening to realize that today we have taken politics and literally trying to make it funny. We actually are attacking people. We're not laughing at the irony of race. We're laughing at and using race as a tool to move a political point or to weaken somebody else's position. And I think that's the tragedy of the day when it comes to racism. And there's no real discourse in race today. Tom and anyone who reads the book will have to say what we were doing back then at the times when race was a killing matter. It wasn't a matter of, you know, it was something that was threatening. I mean, as mentioned in the book, we were beat up several times just for being on stage together. And yet we were able to get people to laugh and not feel uneasy by the mere fact a black man and a white man were standing up there comfortable in their skin. Whereas today, people are using race as a weapon, and even in comedy. Comics are angry. It's the punchline. We're laughing at people. So I don't know today that we're not only are we not having the discourse, I don't know in humor are we equipped to make it as funny as I think it should be. We should be laughing at lipstick on a pig. It shouldn't be a political statement.
There is one more question that popped up if you want it that about earlier, which and this came up on a couple other shows as a matter of fact. There's been a lot of talk about the fact that late night comics, you know, on those late night shows, and you know, The Daily Show, Comedy Central, and things, they seem to be having a very difficult time making fun of Barack Obama, where they have no problem making fun of Joe Biden or Sarah Palin or, you know, just the rest of the pack. Is it that Barack Obama's just not a funny guy, or do you think our culture is still not ready? Are they afraid of making those same kind of late-night David Letterman jokes because they might be perceived as being racist?
Well, that's the politically correct police that will do that to you. I mean, I would think from what I see of Barack Obama that in what I saw on the Al Smith thing that he would be the first to say, have some fun, enjoy yourself.
Have you seen his ears?
on that Al Smith show. Barack Obama was a scream, by the way. He was very funny.
Well, that's the point. I mean, he looks like a Volkswagen coming down the street with the doors open. But you know, you could again. I think once he gets in place, if he gets elected, and it looks right by the polls that's going to happen, then. Everybody can then he'll be open game. I think. I think that a president's there comes a time. I mean, look, Tim and I were a great example of this. Tim and I, when we were writing material, when we were hanging out together, folks, I'm going to go back. That was 40 years ago. 40 years ago, we were so comfortable in our skin that we could tease one another, joke one another. But if Tim said something that I thought was racist or something, I could talk him with it. Or if I said something, Tim would correct me. He wouldn't get mad at me. He'd say, "Tom, I don't know if you understand it or not, but that's what it was all about." But immediately, we all, as Tim says, the pundits are going to be the judges now. The whole world comes down on you. And a good example was when Joe Biden was asked the question a year ago, "What do you think of Barack Obama?" He said, "Oh, I think he's clean, he's articulate," and the whole world came down on. But oh, what did you mean by that? Did you mean to say that other black people don't bathe? I mean, it was stupid.
I remember
that. Betty Jo, thank you for taking my call, by the way, and I look forward to getting the book. I'm glad you pointed it out to us.
Well, thank you for calling, Jazz, and for relaying some of the information from the chat. I really, really appreciate it. So, Will, I want to mention that Jazz's show, Midstream Radio, is one of the best blog talk radio shows. And when is it on, Jazz?
Thursdays at 1 p.m. Eastern. We'll be on this Thursday.
Very good. I just don't ever like to miss it. So thank you. We'll let you go back to chat and see what's going on there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jazz. I was wondering in terms of the book, Tim and Tom, what's the most important thing that you want people to know about you and about the book? We've covered a lot of territory, but what's the thing that you want to stand out? Tim, would you take that first?
Okay. For me, it was the importance of passion in the things that you choose to do in life, and also the ability to survive, what it takes to survive, the commitment that it takes to accomplish some of the goals we set out to do. If there's one thing that you'll see about Tim and Tom's career, if I may speak of them in third person, is that and no matter what came before them, no matter what happened to them, they were able to overcome it and still stay focused on their ultimate dream. And because of that, they were able to accomplish it. And I think that when I talk to young people, and we were just talking to some young people the other day, I remember one of them saying, "Why didn't you guys quit when that happened or when that happened?" And there were so many of that happened in our life and we never quit. We just never quit. And we've had the success because of that.
That's a good message to send out to youngsters, I think, or to anyone. How about you, Tom?
Well, I think that you'll find that if you read our book, it is inspirational, it's motivational. It is about friendship, it's about hardship, it's about brotherhood, it's about all those things. It's about it's what life is. There's ups and downs and how you deal with it. But, courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes it's just a quiet voice at the end of the day saying, "I'll try again tomorrow," and the other thing that you'll probably get from the book is that it's up to you. I have a sign on my desk right now as I'm speaking that said, "If it is to be, it's up to me." It's up to you. It's entirely up to you. And this just might be all you ever need to know, and that's what our book, I think you'll see that even the friendship that we have, as our careers went our separate ways, I'm still his biggest fan. I mean, I was so glad, like he pointed out, he was happy for me. I would change channels when I was on the road and look for where Tim was appearing on a show or something. And like I said, he's done so many shows, he's getting a check as we speak, So I would find him, and I'd watch him perform, and I'd be so happy for him, That's what the book is about.
I love the idea of the one of the themes being friendship and the ups and downs, and this book is just rich with humanity and rich with entertainment, rich with laughs, rich with drama. Everything, as I say, goes back to the fact that I want it to be a movie. I definitely would like to see that. I was wondering if there. Excuse me, who did I interrupt?
Oh, it's Jim.
Jam, yes.
Yeah. I don't know if the audience knows this, but, of course, Tim Reed has been a huge success his whole life. But now, you know, he likes to go on to new things. Well, now he's Louis B. Mayer movie mogul of Virginia because he owns his own studio. And, Tim, would you like to comment about that?
Well, I'm sort of Leroy B. Mayer in Virginia. But nonetheless.
Hey, Tim, that was funny, Tim.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Let's write that down. That was funny.
I'm writing it down as we speak. Okay.
But at any rate, that's something that both Tom and I have talked about. My thing was, all right, let's make sure the book is as successful as it can be so that it gives it more legitimacy as opposed to just, you know, hey, this is a good idea for a movie. Let's make people first interested in the book. But, yeah, I think it has wonderful opportunity as a feature, and we've actually been talking to some people about it. But, you know, first things first, let's make the book successful.
Right. And are there any other projects that you're working on, Tim, as a producer and director?
Well, I've been doing a lot of documentaries and traveling around the world, actually shooting them, and have some now that we're finishing up that I've been shooting over in Africa. And hopefully we'll start another one on has to do with the history of Virginia very shortly. So, you know, I'm very interested in the people of African descent, not just in America, but who traveled for the 500 years from Africa to other parts of the world and had an impact on their history. I just found out that a black Moor ruled Florence from 1537 for 7 to 8 years, and he was the last Medici. He was a bastard child of one of the Medicis. And I found that to be an extraordinary story when I discovered it this past summer in Italy.
Well, that's interesting. That would be a good movie.
Yeah.
Did he say a black Moor ruled Detroit? I heard him say something about
a black Moor.
Oh, a black Moor.
Well, you were right on both counts. Is it?
Well, what do you like doing the most? Do you like the directing, the producing, the acting?
Well, I mean, all that was part of my career path, and I enjoyed directing, acting as well. But I would say being in control of the material is the most exciting part. My passion right now is sculpting. That's where I was this summer in Italy. I'm a sculptor, and I've been doing that now for about 4 or 5 years to keep me from going crazy when I'm not working.
Multi-talented artist. And what about you, Tom? What have you been up to lately?
Well, I my stand-up comedy, it keeps me busy all the time doing stand-up.
Right.
You know, at different, a lot of corporate dates, but I also do a master of ceremonies for a lot of major functions. One company has me do like 8 of these a year, where you're the master of ceremonies for their awards banquet, as well as I run the evening, and then I also can do a monologue within the confines of that. And then the other thing is I wrote a one-man play called Shining Shoes and Sinatra. It opens with me shining shoes in a bar in the south side of Chicago as I did as a little boy, and Sinatra's on the jukebox, and it ends with me carrying his coffin as I did. So it's the journey from that little boy to carrying Frank Sinatra's coffin. And in that play, I've done it like 5 times now, but there's also a segment on Tim and Tom and what that was like too, you know.
Oh, that sounds very moving.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of tears and a lot of laughter, but for a stand-up comedian, as Tim will tell you, to stand up on the stage and make people laugh for an hour is challenging in itself, but that laughter keeps you going. But to stand on a stage and be up there 10, 12, 14 minutes with no laughter because that's not what this scene is going for, that's also pretty scary sometimes. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
You've been funny your whole life. Is there any other career that has interested you, like being an architect or a
or like Tim, you mean? Tim got the idea of sculpting when we were working the Playboy circuit. I'm pretty sure he was thinking that. But no, but I mean, well, you know what? Obviously, as a boy, I've always been very athletic. I played fast pitch softball up until about 6 years ago out here, and you know, I've run marathons and done all those kind of things. But golf. Sometimes I fantasize because I'm a 5 handicap this month. It fluctuates all the time. You know, sometimes you say, gee, wouldn't it be great to be a professional golfer? But that's just a fantasy, not near a reality. I'll tell you the one thing that I am that a lot of people don't know in my humble way. I'm a good actor, but a lot of people don't know that because I've never really been given the good opportunity to be directed properly. I don't always make the right choices as an actor, but I can take good direction. And I think that's the one thing I'd like to maybe do, something really dramatic one time, you know.
Did I see you in the Man in the Moon, with that
yes.
Jim Carrey, where he played
yes.
Andy Kaufman?
Yes, I was in it. I've been in about 20 movies where I played me.
Well, that was a stretch.
Yeah, stretch. Yeah, but I have space balls, and I do cameos, and I do those kind of things. But given the right opportunity, that I'd love to do it. Groucho Marx once said to give a comedian a dramatic role is like giving them a day at the beach. You know, comedians can do drama easy. Comedy's hard, you know.
I think yeah. you're right about that. Well, maybe with the proper makeup, you can play Tom Dreesen in the movie Tim and Tom.
So if you really want me to be a stretch, I want to play Tim.
Oh, you want to play Tim? that would be a draw. You remember?
If you read the book, Tim had more fun.
Yeah, he sure did. We won't go into that on the program, but I think that's definitely a true statement. Well, James, we only have a few more minutes left. Do you have any other questions that you'd like to ask Tim or Tom?
Well, I think at being a comedian, you are sort of naturally an actor, wouldn't you say, Tom and Tim?
Well, I mean, you're naturally, you know, it comes natural to have that ease of going in front of the camera or whatever. But the problem with a comedian who becomes an actor, as much as we hear about actors, comics are better actors. There are only a few of them ever even come close to winning an Oscar. You know, Red Buttons probably, and one or two other, the only ones ever to win an Oscar who were actually comics. And the reason is, it's not so much they don't have the ability, it's that they're used to working with themselves and an audience. And when you work as an actor, you have to work with a third entity, the other actor. It's not just performing for oneself. And I think a lot of comics forget that, and they get in, and it's more of a performance of one's self and ability as opposed to interrelating with the scene and the actors. So that's one of the problems. As a director, that's the problem I've had in directing comics.
You know, this could be fodder for two or three shows. I just hate to say this, but our time is almost up, and I want to be sure to thank you so much, Tim and Tom. You've been such splendid guests. You've been candid, and you've been entertaining, and you've given us a lot to think about. And I want to thank James also for returning to help us, as well as thank Demos and Jazz for helping us out in the chat, and Jazz for calling in as he always does. I really do appreciate that. So we're going to have to wrap things up now, and this is Betty Jo Tucker giving a big shout out to the folks at Blog Talk Radio, especially my producer extraordinaire, Nikki Starr, for all their support in connection with Movie Addict Headquarters. And I want to thank everyone who listened live or to the archives or took part in the chat or called in. And of course, today that was the wonderful Jazz Shaw. Your participation is greatly appreciated. And remember, dear listeners, don't let your life become worse than a horror movie by falling victim to identity theft, the fastest growing crime in America. Instead, go to lifelock.com and sign up for the important services provided there. That's LIFELOCK, lifelock.com. You'll receive a 10% discount by using our special code, which is REALTALK. That's REELTALK, and it's all one word. Please come back next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time when the Mad Movie Man and I pick the best and worst ghost movies ever made. In the meantime, check out our film reviews at realtalkreviews.com. That's R-E-E-L, realtalkreviews.com. Now here's A.J. Daniels to close the show with a song Nikki and I dedicate to all our Blog Talk Radio listeners.
Stay with me and be true. and the